It is absolutely essential that I understand the mercy of God. It is from that understanding, a deep heart understanding of the mercy of God, that I can confess my sin and that I can forgive other people.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
On many occasions, people have come into counseling with some really heavy, heavy burdens. And they have told me that they have asked forgiveness from God about certain issues in their life, and yet they still have the burden of those things. They feel very, very guilty about it. I remember in particular a woman that I worked with who came in just with a tremendous weight of guilt because of an abortion she had had years before. When I started talking to her about it, she said, "No, I can't talk about it because I prayed, I asked God for forgiveness, and now it's done. And it would be an act of faithlessness for me to talk about this again. It would add a burden on me, not just the abortion, but not believing that God has forgiven me." She was really in knots. Tied in knots. Uh-huh. As you can tell, there was no way for her to go.
Mm-hmm. What was her reasoning about not even talking about it? I'm not sure I follow.
She had prayed and asked God forgiveness. And she believed that if you ask God forgiveness, then you need to put it behind you. You need to forget it as though it never occurred.
As if it never occurred.
Right.
See. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, I think that's... I rarely run into people who have that extreme of view, but I do think in milder forms you see quite often people who think that to forgive means to, in one way or another, make it as if it never happened, kind of to forget it and move on and not acknowledge it any longer, which I think is a huge mistake, because if we're making it like it never happened, then there's nothing left to forgive. There's nothing there to forgive. That it's really actually a part of forgiveness that everyone concerned, God and me and anyone else concerned, acknowledges exactly what it was that took place, are able and willing to call it what it was, and yet say, "But we will be merciful here rather than demand judgment. God will be merciful rather than demand judgment." But I think we've even talked about this in the past, that you can't very well extend mercy to someone. It's not really mercy if you're tolerating or reframing or redefining what the act was. If we're saying, "Well, it's just nothing. You know, there was no injury, there was no harm, there was no offense, there wasn't anything outrageous there," then why do we call it mercy? If it wasn't outrageous, it was no big deal. We just need to grow up and be mature about it. And God just needs to be mature about it. But if what we did was outrageously shameful, then we can't deny the reality of its shamefulness. It was what it was. And to remember that it was that and to acknowledge what it was that is perfectly appropriate. But forgiveness is extending mercy to that outrage rather than the judgment that it deserves.
And I think people would say then that if we get mercy, then the mercy means we don't have to remember what we've done. Of course, yeah, it was outrageous. It was really bad. This woman would say the abortion was absolutely terrible. In fact, she called it murder. Mm-hmm. So she did see it as awful. And yet she also thought God wanted her to forget it, that forgiveness meant she didn't have to think about it ever again, that God's mercy had been extended, and that was the end of it.
Yes, but see, our mind can play some real tricks on us, because what we call God extending mercy can be, the way we're really thinking about it, asking God to be a collaborator in denial with us, to collaborate in our just kind of pretending like it didn't happen, and that God has come along and said, okay, I agree, let's pretend together like it didn't happen. And that's not forgiveness, and that's not mercy. The reason we prefer that at times is because we don't really know God. We don't really understand God, and we don't really believe that if God acknowledged that it was that outrageous what I did, that he would still accept me. And since we don't believe that, our only choice is to somehow hide the outrage from myself and from God. And we see it as good news that God has become a collaborator in that. He's agreed to kind of shield it from his vision and not acknowledge it. He will pretend like it didn't happen.
Well, Jack, there's a verse that often comes up. It's in Psalm 103. I believe it's verse 12. Let me start at verse 11. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his loving kindness toward those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. And people have oftentimes used that verse to say, you know, God couldn't forget it more. East is as far from the west as could possibly be.
Okay. The question is, this is poetry. And the question always in poetry is, this is an image, a picture, a metaphor of something, but what is it a picture and metaphor of? We import the idea that it's a metaphor of how much God is denying or forgetting or obscuring from his vision. But that's certainly not required by what the psalm is saying. And I would argue rather that what he has in mind is, this is how far he's separating what I have done from my judgment. In other words, when it comes to the question of what's the relevant data for whether I will favor this person and bless this person or curse this person and damn this person, when it comes to the question of judgment, the fact that I have done that is going to be so irrelevant to that judgment that it's as far as the east is from the west. And that's, I think, what the imagery is there. It's not that somehow God can't recollect what I did, that he somehow, that's not available to his memory any longer, but rather he has committed himself to making that utterly and completely irrelevant to the issue of whether or not I will be acceptable to him. That's forgiveness.
You know, as you're talking, I was thinking about Paul, the Apostle Paul, and how he was such a murderer and hurtful. He created wreckage in the lives of many, many Christians prior to the time that he became a believer himself. And if I'm remembering right, in the book of Romans, he recollects what he did, kind of parades it out as, you know, that's what he did, that was what was wrong. It seems like he was very bold in not forgetting what had happened, and in fact reminding us and reminding himself of what had happened. Two things I think of from that. One is, he must have understood the mercy of God pretty clearly, because he wasn't working at collaborating in denial with God.
Right, right. Yeah, that's true. He talks about, calls himself a Pharisee of Pharisees, and then I think he follows that with, as to zeal, a persecutor of the church. And he even recognizes what was motivating him there. I think he had a lot of self-understanding about who he used to be and what he was, enough to recognize that his condition there was ignorant and that it was foolish and that it was mean-spirited. And I think he recognizes all those things about himself.
And he was definitely remembering it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I think clearly Paul didn't have this contemporary perspective that we have, that you really need to forget the transgressions. And I guess the question comes to mind is, why, if it's true that God does not want us to forget, as Paul did not, why would God not want us to forget? What advantage would we have in remembering what we've done wrong? For Paul to remember these things he did, for this woman that I mentioned in the beginning to remember her abortion. Is he just trying to make us feel bad?
Well, let me back up a second. He wants us to remember. I guess I think I'd put it differently. He doesn't want us to deny. I don't know that there's any merit. It's not like we need to make a practice or a discipline of reminding ourselves and keeping it fresh and keeping it alive and keeping it dramatic. I don't know. I wouldn't go so far as to say there's any virtue in that. If the memory becomes dim, if the memory becomes dull, if our life goes on and it seems far away, I think that's fine. If it just does so naturally as the course of a fading memory.
Well, I wouldn't go in either direction. I wouldn't be a dramatic at trying to remember it, nor would I be dramatic at trying to forget it. I like what
right,
you said,
right.
is that it, if it goes away with the passing of time, having dealt with it, then that's a fine thing. But to try and move it away, to try and pull down the curtain as though it didn't exist, is a very different thing than what I think you're talking
right,
about.
Right, exactly, yeah. So it's what I put the emphasis on. There's a wrong thing we can do, and that is, as you say, try to make it go away. Do what we can to deny it and to repress the memory and that kind of thing. It's unbelieving ultimately. That's why God would not want us to do it, because the only reason for doing that would be because we don't have any confidence in the mercy of God. We expect that he would reject us if it were fully out in the open who we were and what we had done. And that's one of the most important issues that we as believers have to come to terms with, is the mercy of God, because it's essential to our whole standing in God's eyes. It's essential to our whole destiny. It's essential to our whole well-being, is that God must be merciful, because if God is not merciful, then we're all sunk. So the sooner we can come to terms with who this God is, who's our Creator, that he's an essentially merciful God who has no desire to give us what we deserve, that he would rather bless us and intends to do so, and we make ourselves people who are going to receive that mercy and that blessing if we simply trust him and believe in that mercy and believe in that blessing instead of rebelling against it.
Well, Jack, I want to go back to my question for a moment, though I'm leaving the mercy issue too quickly. I'm really glad that you brought it up. I think we need to bring it up all the time. I don't think we can bring it up enough. And so many people are suffering from a lack of understanding of God's mercy
right.
and ever believing that it could ever be true, especially for them, maybe for someone else. And I hear that a lot. Yeah, I can really understand God extending mercy towards so-and-so or my whole church, but toward me, absolutely not. I've been too bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, really a tragedy. But I want to go back to my question again. Why would God not want us to forget? And you clarified that as... Well, it isn't that he wants us to be histrionic about it and bring it up and try and remember it as hard as we can and never allow the passing of time, the fading away of something to occur. And I made the clarification that I think we have to work through it first. And I'd like to go back and help people understand what I meant by that, because that's kind of a big statement. Let me do that by way of example. I think of a number of people. I work with a lot of people who have been sexually abused. And one of the things that many Christians have decided they need to do is just, as they say, forgive and forget. And what they mean by forgiveness is perhaps just pray a prayer and decide to say, God, I forgive so-and-so, and then just move on. I would say that that is not working through it, perhaps to some degree for some people, but certainly that's not the extent of what these people need. And the telltale signs of they're trying to forget is a great deal of dysfunction, particularly in their sexual relationships, perhaps in their marriages, or not in their marriage, perhaps in promiscuity, some kind of sexual dysfunction that occurs, and certainly other areas that can become dysfunctional as a part of this. But having not worked through it, what we do is it comes up for us anyway. It comes up in our dreams. It comes up in our behavior. It comes up in our relationships. It comes up in our sense of guilt toward what has been done toward us. It comes up, particularly with people who have been sexually abused, thinking that they're the problem. And so working through means understanding perhaps that I was a victim, if indeed that was the case. I wasn't the person who was at fault. working through the sexual issues such that I can have a sexual relationship with somebody in the future. Work through the memories, work through the pain, work through the thoughts. Think about it, perhaps for a long period of time. Not just set it aside as though it did not exist.
I think that's part of what wisdom, I mean, it is definitely what part of what wisdom is that if I just have, if my brain is just a muddle toward life and reality and God and me and this event and everything, then I don't understand it. And if I don't understand it, in all likelihood, I have all kinds of foolish ideas and notions and perceptions. And that foolishness is going to work its way out in the choices I make and the attitudes I have in my psychological and emotional experience. Those are just going to be affected by lies and deceptions and distortions and, you know, false ideas of one kind or another. So to become wise means to, and you're right, this can take some time, but to sort out in the light of what the scripture tells me, in the light of God's revelation, what's the truth here? How much of my life and my experience is a result of my sin? How much is a result of somebody else's sin? To begin to draw the line and have the kind of discernment to be able to do that. And somebody could say, well, I'm a sinner, what difference does it make? Well, it makes a huge amount of difference. Because if I can't tell the difference between when I'm sinning and someone else is sinning against me, then I don't know. I don't have wisdom. I don't have understanding. I don't have discernment. I'm not the sort of discerning person that God wants me to be. It's part of my sanctification to be able, in the light of my own experience, to begin to understand the categories for understanding experience. I don't understand sin at all if I can't know when I'm the sinner and know the difference between me sinning and somebody else sinning against me. Then I don't understand sin. And I must understand sin to be wise.
I must understand sin to be wise, and I must understand sin, both what is mine and what is yours, in order for me to live my life.
Right.
You know, I just think of people who cannot do that, and I know this is kind of an extreme, but Jack, it happens a lot, is I work with people who do a lot of self-mutilating in some way or another. They cut themselves, they get in multiple kind of accidents, falling, they pull out their eyelashes, they pull out their hair, they scratch themselves, they put themselves in dangerous situations, you know, they pull at their lip, they bite their lip, they bite their fingers, those kinds of things. Some that are very, very damaging, some people use knives, they come close to killing themselves, because they see themselves as the sole problem in the world. They have not been able to separate what is my issue and what is somebody else's, and they are self-imposing some kind of very, very hurtful behavior toward themselves.
Yeah. If my understanding is a muddle, my life is going to be a muddle. I just think there's a direct connection. And as chaotic as my understanding is, that's how chaotic my life is going to be.
But I want to add from a counselor's perspective that what I'm talking about is not any easy thing. There's so many people who have taken on the perspective that I just need to forget all that's happened to me. But Jack, to bring up those old issues again and to visit them becomes just a daunting task for people. And many times people feel like they're going backwards in having to face into what they've tried to forget and to work it through. It's a long process. It's a difficult process. And I would say, first and foremost, it's a courageous process. And it does bring wisdom. And as we have wisdom, very often we have much more peace in our lives, much more satisfaction in how we move in our life and in our relationships. So there's a great payola, but boy, it is a very, very difficult task.
I would imagine that for most people, in order to do it, they have to get a better view of God. Their view of God has to begin to change before they have the freedom to do that. Has that been your experience, or... I think if I didn't have the confidence that there was mercy there waiting at the other end of the road somehow, I couldn't find the courage to revisit some of my shame.
I think you're exactly right. I hesitated here for a minute because I was thinking of an experience I had once with I was going to counseling, and I was working with a non-Christian counselor. And she worked really well with me trying to bring up things that I needed to work on. But we got to a point where it was essential that I would just understand God's mercy. And I knew that. Or I just couldn't go any deeper. I just couldn't look at the bottom of what I needed to look at. And what she did was to bring up the bottom for me. She ended up telling me how good I was, kind of stroking me in a way that really wasn't true. I wasn't good in these situations. I can't remember particularly what I was working with at the time, but I knew that I needed to understand my own guilt. I needed to understand my own contribution to the problem. And I was really jolted when she brought me up from the bottom. I knew I could travel to the bottom. I knew that God's mercy was down there. But she didn't help me go there. And I think that that's really what happens in contemporary psychology a lot, is they don't have the sense of God's mercy, and there's no way they can let you go down there. Their fear would be, the only thing left would be suicide. Mm-hmm. And so I think ultimately you're right. Unfortunately, I think that happens a lot of the time. Counselors have asked me, aren't you very afraid to bring people there? Because I do a lot of work that helps people get to the bottom of what's going on in their lives. And absolutely not, because I know that at the bottom there's God, and that He is merciful. And so it doesn't scare me to help people go there. Yeah, they have to have a lot of support to go there. They have to have a pretty good understanding of who God is. But part of the way they understand who God is through my interaction with them that is merciful. And they get a piece of that, and they can understand, oh, maybe then God could be that way. And so it's a very powerful and important relationship that I forge with these people, and they end up ultimately understanding the mercy of God in an incredible way, much more so than they could if they just tried to buffer themselves from the reality of their lives.
Yeah.
You follow me?
Yeah.
Jack, I'm often so amazed by you understanding what I'm saying as a counselor, because I get so much flack about being a Christian counselor, and yet, you know, I kind of expect, okay, there's going to be a point where Jack's going to go, wait a minute, Christine, you've just gone too far.
Well, what I understand you to be saying is simply that you are playing the role of someone who understands the process that God wants people to go through in sanctification, and you're standing and watching it happen at the same time that you're helping them, supporting them, encouraging them, giving them the help, helping with your wisdom to take them to see what they need to see, to understand what they need to understand, to conclude what they need to conclude as they look at the events of their lives and learn from their own lives.
Yeah, and I
just think that's what God is doing in everybody's life, one way or another. We can't become sanctified without that. And you're just becoming a part of that process in their lives.
Yeah, and, you know, for some people, it's just a very incredible tool that God uses in their lives. I certainly don't think it's the only tool that God uses, using a counselor to go through this process. But I absolutely agree with you. It is the process. Mm-hmm. And I just feel really honored as I have the opportunity to see people do it. Mm-hmm. And very much, I am a watcher as much as I am a facilitator, because I'm very aware of God bringing people to a place, and I just help them see where they are from one step to the next.
And the thing I can see that would be very helpful to people would be to come into a context where they expect one thing and they get another, because, namely, they expect rejection and they get mercy. Because I would imagine that their perception of the Christian counterculture is that I really need to watch and not reveal too much of myself, because if I reveal too much of myself, then they'll really know what I'm really all about, and they will reject me. They will disenfranchise me somehow.
Oh, my heavens.
So they probably come in expecting that that's what you're going to do when they finally open up.
Absolutely. And people deal with it in different ways. Some people come in and they tell me the worst things about their lives right off the bat.
Thinking that we'll be done here, huh?
Yeah, I molested this person. Okay, so they're going to get to walk out because I'm going to be astonished and not be able to find any way to relate to them. And I think sometimes they're really disappointed because I don't give them the rejection that they're expecting. Sometimes people wait and wait and wait, and all of a sudden, a long time later, they come out with with a series of confessions, because they have tested me in little ways or really danced a dance to find out who I am. And they come out with it still in fear and trembling, but they think maybe I'm going to stick with them. But people are often very amazed. Now, I have to say, I kind of sound like, I'm starting to sound like this saint. And I don't want to sound that way in a counseling office where the situation is very controlled, where I absolutely know my boundaries, and where, for the most part, I'm not really that exposed myself in terms of my own behavior. I am exposed in terms of my character, very definitely, and people test it to the hilt. But I'm not with them, living with them day to day. I would say in my marriage, it's far more difficult to be as non-rejecting, as empathetic, as loving to my husband, as it is for me to be empathetic and long-suffering with people in my office.
Right, yeah.
But it's a good place for people to learn it. And the reality is, if I didn't actually feel a sense or know a sense of oneness with people, because I am a sinner also, they would not open up to me. Mm-hmm. Because they would know. They would.
You're
know.
Not just play acting. It's real.
It's real.
It's a real understanding of the mercy of God.
But it's not as tested.
Right, right.
As my life lived out every day.
Yeah, no, I understand that as well. It's one thing to grasp the vision of the mercy of God in the gospel as a Bible teacher and as a pastor. It's an entirely another thing to go home and live your life in the light of that. Those are very different.
You know, I had someone come up to me the other day and they said, you know, it was so encouraging, Christine, to hear Jack on the radio because I didn't think he failed at all. And it was really, really great to hear that Jack even fails. Is that kind of surprising?
Well, it is, because I live with me every day. It doesn't surprise me, but I do understand that. I remember in college kind of becoming spiritually and intellectually awakened to the things of Christianity for the very first time. And there's one particular Bible teacher in a church near our university who I just kind of followed around and went to every Bible study he taught, because I was just soaking up this new information, this new thing. I mean, I'd been a Christian all my life, but I really wanted to know. I was very hungry, and so I just followed him around. And I can remember seriously having a conversation, I mean, not seriously, half seriously, having a conversation with my housemates at the house where we lived, whether or not this particular Bible teacher might not in fact be an angel that God had sent down, and he wasn't really human, because we asked the question, has anyone ever seen him sin? No, I haven't seen him sin. So nobody had seen him sin, so we suspected maybe he was an angel. Now, we were only half serious, but it represents a perception that we can easily get of Bible teachers, pastors, ministers, and so on. We see them in very controlled situations. We don't live with them day in and day out, and they're always doing their job. And I understand that it's not that there's anything inauthentic about their job. I mean, they really do believe it. It really is their commitments. Not all of them. Some, you can find fraudulent pastors as well. But, you know, but even your most sincere and authentic pastor who really is committed to the things that they teach and the things that they say and really are striving to live their life in the light of that are humans, are sinful human beings. And when they're not on the job, when it's not also a part of their job that gives an extra motive and incentive.
Yeah.
When they're just letting their guard down and being themselves, there's all kinds of obnoxious behavior that can come out of them, all kinds of selfishness and pride and junk that's there.
But, you know, sometimes also people come out looking at us in rose-colored glasses. They have this expectation of who we're going to be, and they make that of us. I was talking to a woman recently, not someone I work with as a counselor, but a person that's in and out of my life some. And she said, you know, Christina, I just need to be honest about this particular issue. And she told me that she, I don't want to say exactly what it was, but she had done something quite wrong and that she thought I didn't know and wanted to come clean with me. Well, I had known that she had done it, and it was okay with me if she didn't want to be honest. I figured it was up to her if she did or not, and it didn't affect our relationship. And she said, you know, you're kidding. You knew that? And all of a sudden, it was like she made me even, she had these rose-colored glasses that make me pretty perfect. And she said, I can't believe it. You know what? I told my mom, this is an adult woman, but I told my mom that I would like to be just like Christine. She is just the perfect woman. And I just about died. I hate that perception. I can hardly believe it. But I think she walks into particular situations in her life and just assumes because these some of these things are true that that's also, you know, it follows that this is going to be kind of a perfect situation, that I was kind of an angel. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of hard to get out of that. That sometimes even.
Yeah, because we have a desire to find those people that, that somehow rise above and transcend. And
I think it's because then I get to be like that.
It
gives me
right.
the opportunity that maybe I'm going to be able to be an angel someday.
Yeah, if they've made it, maybe I can make it too. And yeah, that's where the gospel is a bit of a wet blanket in that regard. And there are a lot of people who really don't like my teaching, my Bible teaching, for that reason, because it seems too negative and too pessimistic and so on, because it dashes our hopes of transcending our sinfulness here and now in this world. But wet blanket though it may be, I think I'm convinced it's reality. It's the reality of my experience. It's the reality that of the Bible as I have understood through the study of the Scripture, is that our glory awaits us in the next age, not here.
And yet, I think, as you said earlier, you also have a great emphasis on God's mercy, that even as we're sinners, we're in great need of forgiveness, and God does offer that forgiveness. He is merciful toward us. His judgment is for our sin as far as the east is from the west.
Right, right.
Jack, let's go on to another couple of issues on forgiveness before we end today. One of them is that there's a common belief that what I need to do in order to be forgiven is to confess. Now, the Catholics would say I need to go into to a priest and confess. Can you talk about that some? Do you tie those together, confession and forgiveness?
Well, partly we're faked out by all the cop shows that we watch on television, where to confess...
Didn't expect you to say that. The cop shows.
Yeah. To confess a crime is to tell somebody about it, to tell somebody that you did it. And so that has come in our idiom to be one of the meanings of confess, is to kind of fess up, that is to acknowledge it to somebody. I'm not convinced that the Greek word that gets translated confess has that connotation at all. Rather what the word means is to something like our word acknowledge, or probably even a better synonym, to agree, that we come to a harmonious judgment on my action in harmony with God's judgment on my action, in sync with God's judgment. So that God sees it as shameful, as rebellious, as evil, as perverse, as damnable. Do I see it in that light? Do I see it as shameful and damnable and perverse and all those things that God would say about it? To line up my perspective toward it with God's perspective toward it, that's confession. That's coming into agreement with God, in effect. So the essential part of confession is not telling somebody else about it. The essential part of confession is looking squarely at it and calling it what it is, to myself. I mean, most importantly, to myself.
And here we go back to what we said last time we talked, Jack, is that forgiveness is really a matter of the heart, as is confession. Confession is a matter of our heart, whether or not we say it with our words. Our words, they're only real if they express what's already in our heart, which is, as you're saying, an agreement with God about the depravity of our sin.
Right. Now, it's understandable to me that some of the things that we do, I feel such deep shame that I would find it very, very, very difficult to admit it to somebody else, to reveal my shame, to show my shame to them. Now, ultimately, should we be willing and able to do that? Yes, ultimately, if called upon, there'd be something spiritually immature about not being able to do that ultimately. But I think we would do so with a great deal of reluctance. If we're not doing it with a great deal of reluctance, I would begin to think that it's not real confession. I mean, you run into people, in fact, more and more in our society, you run into people who are very ready to tell you what they've done. But it's almost, there's a real disconnect there because they're very ready to tell you what they've done. I mean, these incredibly shameful, perverse things, but they don't feel any shame in it. At least it's not apparent that they do.
Shame is in a sense of believing that it's wrong.
Exactly. Exactly.
Understanding its immorality.
Or they may even be acknowledging that it's wrong, but what they're not acknowledging is that it's shameful. I mean, they've sort of redefined wrong so that wrong is wrong, but it's not perverse, it's not shameful, it's not damnable, it's not all these other things that God is saying about it. And the fact that I tell somebody else then is no longer confession, because I'm not agreeing with God in my assessment of it. I don't really think about it the way he thinks about it.
I'm a little bit lost. If somebody, okay. I guess I connect, if something I say something is wrong, then I believe that it is wrong. It was a bad thing for me to have done. That it is damnable. So I'm not understanding the disconnect.
Well, some people revel in wrong. They glory in wrong. They glory in shame. To glory in shame is not to confess sins, is not to confess a sin. I mean, where you really get it, where you really see it would be on a jacket of a motorcycle gang member that says something like, well, even a phrase, born to be wild, for example, or my memory's escaping me here, but you've seen slogans where people are putting it right out there, I'm a bad person and proud of it. I'm a bad girl. I'm a bad boy. I'm a bad man.
Okay.
And I'm proud of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, so they're not confessing as we're talking about. They're just saying, I'm proud. I'm flaunting.
Exactly.
That I'm a bad guy.
Exactly.
That's cool. And I see what you're saying. And yeah, I do understand. Okay, let me go to a verse real quickly. It's 1 John 1:9. If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness.
Okay.
What would you do with that verse?
That has to be understood in the context of what is going on in 1 John. Why is he writing the letter? And what false teaching and false conceptions are in the background? What is he attacking? What is he defending the gospel against? And it appears to be a kind of false teaching that has borrowed a lot from Greek philosophy, that has argued that you can really divide a human being into two parts. There's his physical material nature, which, according to Greek assumptions, is sort of hopelessly corrupt anyway. I mean, it's just by virtue of the fact that it's physical stuff, it's already morally suspect. It's already an inferior kind of thing. But then a human being also has a spirit. And according to what later became Gnosticism, that spirit was a little divine spark, a little spark of divinity that was kind of imprisoned in the prison house of this physical body. Well, some people concluded, therefore, that we can't really expect our bodies to do anything other than be evil and sinful. So there's no real reason to curb our appetites or to control our passions or do anything to try to impose moral principles on the behavior of my body.
Or restraint. Because,
yeah, no restraint. Because my body is going to be a body.
Okay.
And it's just inferior and just evil. And these people were apparently coming along claiming that that's what Jesus taught. Something very much like that is what Jesus taught. And John is writing to say, look, I was there. I sat by the fire and listened to him teach in person. I was an eyewitness to the whole ministry of Jesus. And I'm telling you, that's not what Jesus taught. Jesus taught us instead that God is light and in him there is no darkness at all. And in order to have fellowship with him, we must walk in the light. That's what he taught us. And it's in that context then that he says, we can confess our sins. That is to say, let's not be attracted to a theology that is trying to deny the sinfulness of sin. That's trying to say, I didn't do that. My body did that. that theology is a way of trying to circumvent the need to look at what I've done and say, I am guilty and I'm shameful because of what I've done. It's a way of excusing me. And so he's saying, if we don't acknowledge our sinfulness, we have no part with him. Part of being a believer, part of being a disciple of Jesus and a child of God, is to look fully and squarely into the face of our sinfulness and acknowledging that it's there, saying we are sinners, we have sinned, we have sinned, to acknowledge all those things and to not deny them. And it's in exactly the context of making that point that he says, if we do confess our sins, what can we expect is the result? He is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. The point that he's making is that if we will do the honest and true and courageous thing of calling our sin what it is, we are not going to get smashed by God. We are not going to get destroyed by God. We are not going to get rejected by God. He's going to extend mercy to us, just as he's promised.
Now we're just coming right back to where we've been. We keep coming back to the same place. If we acknowledge the reality of our sinfulness, we call it what it is. It was immoral, it was debased, it was wrong, it was completely wrong, and we need God's forgiveness for it. If we acknowledge that, then that is offered to us, it's given to us. God's mercy is big enough for whatever is.
Exactly, right.
But it isn't just words that we're talking about.
No, no.
And, you know, I keep thinking about so many people who I've worked with over the years who say, you know, I can't understand why I ask God for forgiveness for this, and it just hasn't gone away. It comes up in my dreams, it comes up in my thoughts, it comes up when I walk by this certain place, it comes up when I'm talking to my husband who committed adultery, and I keep thinking about it, and they just feel so incredibly guilty because they have prayed what they would call perhaps a prayer of forgiveness. Can you address that for a moment, Jack? This one-time prayer of forgiveness, people's sense that you confess it once or you forgive it once and it really ought to be done with. It ought to be out of my consciousness.
Well, I think the fundamental mistake is that we think that our Christian life is made up of a bunch of acts that we perform. And that's not really the case. That the Christian life is a question of taking on certain ways of being. And we grow into those ways of being through many, many different decisions that we make, choices that we make over the course of a lifetime. So, for example, confessing a particular sin that I have committed in the past is not just something that one day we go and say, okay, I did it. Now can we be done with it? That's an attempt to substitute this act, this statement of that I did something wrong, for what God really wants, which is a state of being or a way of being where I really truly have come to have the peace of understanding that I did do this thing back there that was really truly damnable. So that every time it would come up, every time that I would remember it, every time that I would think about it, I would adopt exactly the same attitude toward it. Yes, I did it, and boy, wasn't that damnable. And thank God that he's not going to judge me according to what I deserve. It's entirely possible for someone to not really believe that about what they did in the past. To get God off their back, they'll say, okay, it was a sin. Are you satisfied? But never really believe it from their own heart. Never really own that from within their own soul.
And if I really own that, I like the word, that word, if I really own that, then what happens eventually is it mellows out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to be fighting it anymore. I've met it. I've met my enemy. It's there. It's in front of me. And I think that the mercy of God starts becoming much bigger in that situation, paradoxically.
Yeah.
I see it as big as it is, and God's mercy gets really big. Though, I'm also thinking of the other side. You were talking about confession of something that I've done. I'm thinking about forgiveness also for what has been done against me and the memory coming back and back and back of what these people did. A person might say, you know, I forgive them. I prayed about it. I prayed this prayer of forgiveness, and it keeps on coming back. What is wrong with me? And I think we're coming back to the same, I think you would give me the same answer as, Forgiveness isn't just an act. When we get hit by life from different areas, in different ways, situations come back to us where we have been hurt. And I have found it very true in my own life that I have to think about it from a new perspective and offer forgiveness again to these people in my own heart, again and again and again, just from different perspectives. And I think also as we have forgiven people over time, I think that also mellows. But we have to really face squarely, just as we have faced squarely what we have done, we need to face squarely what people have done against us in order for it to mellow out. I don't really even understand that chemical reaction. It just is such a paradox. To face something, to embrace it, to own it, and that's at the point where it gets to mellow out.
Mm-hmm. Well, in part I understand it, because I imagine you see this a lot, that when I don't face the truth about something, then I have to spend the rest of my life juggling a bunch of lies.
Yeah,
and
hiding.
It gets incredibly complicated.
It is.
So there's something very, very cathartic and something that just resolves itself into the ultimate simplicity when I can just say, well, that's the truth and that's what I believe. And that's how I see it, because mm-hmm. that's the truth. Mm-hmm. And life is no longer complicated in the same way, because I don't have to manage my memories and manage my thoughts and control what I will think about what, when, and so on. I can just relax and let the truth be the truth.
Yeah, my mind. I just work with so many people who have such active minds. They just can't let their minds never stop, because they're doing just that. They're working it in order not to accept the reality of their lives. And that's really the bottom line of pathology, is people having to work their minds so hard. And, of course, their behavior follows, and it just kind of wraps into new things and becomes a tumbleweed of tornado mm-hmm. thoughts that are just, people just have a hard time living inside themselves. It's just tragic.
Yeah, I don't know if I've mentioned this here, but the closest time I ever came to what seemed like insanity to me was when I was refusing to allow something about my life and my history that was just true. It was just the way it was. And I so desperately did not want it to be true that my mind had gone into hyper speed, had gone into warp speed to try to find a way for the truth to not be the truth, for history to not be history. And that's exactly my experience, was thoughts seemingly out of control that I couldn't stop them. I couldn't make them go away.
Oh, you feel so crazy.
Tormented.
Yeah, but you've got these two choices. I'm sure you realize this is what you're saying. We have these two choices very often. It's either face into the pain of the reality, which is absolutely awful for us, and if we don't understand the mercy of God, it feels completely impossible, or we feel crazy.
Right.
And it seems like we can't live with either of those two things. Unfortunately, most people live with feeling crazy rather than facing into the reality of what's happened in their life. We have about a minute. So, Jack, I'm going to give you the awesome task of maybe summarizing a little bit of what we've said today.
Well, I suppose over the last several weeks we've been talking about both confession and forgiveness, and I suppose the bottom line that gets right at the heart of what we would want to communicate about both of those things is that they are heart attitudes, that they come from my ownership of the truth from deep within my being. They're not just words, they're not just acts. They are perceptions that are real and authentic from my own heart. With respect to forgiveness, that I'm embracing the truth and I'm owning the truth, that I'm no better than anyone else, and that God is a merciful God who intends to extend mercy to me, but also to other sinners like me. And therefore, if God is going to extend mercy to them, to me, I can't forbid him to extend mercy to others as well. And I own that truth. And then with respect to confession, that I own the truth that my sin just is what it is. It is the shameful, outrageous, perverse, damnable thing that God says that it is. And owning that from the heart is to confess.
At the end of this century, the big questions about reality and being human rise with unexpected power. We ask ever more agonizingly, what does it mean to be human? How do human beings fit into this vast cosmos? Where to from here? In his News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality, McKenzie Study Center member Wes Hurd shows how our present-day culture answers these questions in radically non-biblical ways. He shows how the prevalent postmodern view of life is fed to us through television, popular music, and education. However, he also states that although postmodernism has many negative aspects, it may present opportunities for biblical Christians to dialogue more openly with people who need real answers to some big questions. Call McKenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality.
Jack, you know what I would like a lot of?
What would you like a lot of? Money?
I would like a lot of money. Actually, the reason that I think of that right now is because here we are at the end of our program again, and we're supposed to be talking to people about contributing to us financially. And you and I are sitting here thinking, scratching our head, how do we creatively do that? How do we ask people for financial contributions? And so that just came to my mind. I thought, I would really like a lot of money because I don't want to have to ask people for money, and I would just like to make this program go just out of my own financial contributions. But the reality is I don't have enough money to make it go, and we really do covet all of you listeners to think about what you might do to financially contribute to this program. If we become independently wealthy, we'll let you guys know. The other day... The reality is, though, Jack, the other day my daughter said to me when we're driving in the car, Mom, if you could have anything you want, what would you have? And, you know, I thought about it for a minute, and she said, it can't be anything about God, Mom. But, you know, I said, so do you want me to lie, Leah? And I just said to her, you know, I would really like to be a person who is wise. I would like to be a person who doesn't sin anymore. And she said, oh, but Mom, isn't that only going to happen in heaven? And she said, yeah. I said, yeah, it will only happen in heaven, but I'd really like that to happen now. I'd like that to happen more than having millions of dollars.
Did she buy it?
You know, I think she was really disappointed, Jack.
Yeah.
It's like, it was like, oh, gee, you are such a killjoy, Mom. I mean, she wanted me to tell her I'd like to have, you know, a condo in Hawaii or... I mean, if anybody wants to give me a condo in Hawaii, that would be great.
Well, it takes a certain amount of life experience to appreciate what's more important, what's more valuable. It's hard for children to understand that, I think.
Oh, impossible.
Impossible.
In fact, 15 years ago, I would have thought anybody that gave that answer, my answer, I would have thought really underneath, they were just giving me a bunch of malarkey.
Yeah, yeah.
You too? It takes a lot of life experience to finally go, oh, I get it. That's what I really want.
Yeah.
Because that would solve everything. To be not to be a sinner and to be wise, we'd have it.
Yep.
We are truly serious about the need for financial support. We're going to keep asking you guys every week, and we hope every week you will think about the possibility of supporting us financially, in a big way or in a small way. We do need your financial contributions, and we do thank you for even considering this as a possibility.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-485. 1-800-273-8501. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.